thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. This week on the Fighter Pilot Podcast, you've been asking for an episode on flight school. Well, you got it, but I hope you're ready for what you're about to get yourself into.
So you never know where it's going to take you, and as long as you have the desire to be successful and you put the time in and you don't let anything, because you're going to have bumps in the way, you're going to have bad events and bad days, stuff's going to happen that make you question, is this the right career choice? Everyone has it at some point. You just got to buckle down and gut it out and get through it, because it is the best job in the world.
Welcome to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, the internet radio show that explores the fascinating world of air combat, the aircraft, the weapon systems, and most importantly, the people. Now, here's your host, retired U.S. Navy fighter pilot, Vincent Aiello.
Hello, everyone. Thank you. That's our musician, Jaime Lopez, having a little fun. Thank you for that, Jaime, and thanks for all the great tunes. Anyway, hello, everybody. This is Vincent Aiello, and welcome to episode 25 of the Fighter Pilot Podcast. We are talking Navy flight school today, and a little primer for that was a snippet of our upcoming interview and a new song for September, as well as some bumper comms taken from the movie Independence Day, which features some F-18 flying from a Marine squadron that is not fictional. It is real. And in fact, it is the squadron our guest comes from as a junior officer. So we'll get to that in just a little bit. And it is a long episode, so we're going to probably skip straight to it. But I do want to take a moment and make one quick announcement. And that is, this episode is being released on September 1st, 2018. And this past week, Naval Aviation and the United States of America lost a hero. John McCain passed away. He was not only a congressman and senator who was devoted to serving the public, but he was also a former A-4 pilot who was shot down in Vietnam and was a prisoner of war while his dad was the boss of the entire Pacific Fleet. So he was harshly treated and has served our country admirably. So we just want to throw a nickel on the grass, as the expression goes, for John McCain, and give our best to his family, including his mother, who is still alive at, I believe, about 106 years old. So our thoughts and prayers to the McCain family. All right, so like I said at the beginning, you have been asking for an episode on flight school. I finally wrangled the guy to talk about it. He is local here in San Diego, and he knows everything you want to know. So without any further ado, strap on, because this is a long one, a lot of detail. But even those of you who probably won't have a chance to ever go through it, I still think you'll learn something and be entertained. So stick around, and we'll meet back up at the end.
I'm fly. I'm pilot.
All right, today on the Fighter Pilot Podcast, we have our very first Marine joining us. Major Mike Walsh, BS, welcome to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, bud.
Hey, thanks, Joe. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, well, sorry it took 25 episodes, but this should be the 25th. So, you know, we're building up to a big event there on the mile marker there, 25. Okay, excellent. Well, people are going to love this episode because they have been asking for a discussion on flight school. So we're going to find out in a moment where you are and what you know about. And so let's just jump right into it. Let's start with, where are you from? How'd you get in the military? And what are you doing now?
Yeah, so I'm from Milton, Mass., just outside of Boston. One of four brothers. Played every sport growing up. Just kind of typical, you know, child growing up. And then in terms of the military, I didn't have a whole lot of military in the family. I think my grandfathers both were in World War II, but that's pretty much it. And we didn't have any aviators in the family either, but I just always had kind of this burning desire to be a pilot and to be a military pilot. And then when I was in high school, I saw and learned about really the Marine Officer Candidate School and kind of what options they had in terms of aviation. and said, hey, I think that's for me. My dad had a lot of friends that were Marines, and they were always just the best guys. And so I had a really high opinion of Marines in general, and then I figured out what could be better than being a Marine but being a Marine pilot. So went to college, graduated in 2006.
Where'd you go?
I went to St. Anselm College. It's up in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Okay.
I played a little hockey up there and then went into the Marines in 2006.
Okay. Yeah. And so you went through our subject for today, which is flight school. We can skip that for the moment. And then give us a little rundown on what some of your tours were.
Yeah, so did the flight school thing. We'll get into that in a second. And then I went through VMFAT 101. That's the F-18 Fleet Replacement Squadron, where you learn how to fly the Hornet. Did that for about a year and change, and then I went over to VMFA 314, the Black Knights, just down the flight line up at Miramar in San Diego. I did 5 years there, roughly. Ended my tour there as the pilot training officer. Saw some combat over in Operation Inherent Resolve, did a couple of deployments to the CENTCOM area, and one rotation through the Pacific, so kind of all over the place in a relatively short period of time.
Okay, and so where are you now?
So right now I'm back at 101 as an instructor, so it's kind of come full circle a little bit. Started as a student, did the fleet thing, and now I'm back at 101 as an instructor teaching the new up-and-coming guys and gals how to do it in the F-18.
Excellent. Okay. And that is the subject for today. Now, you being a Marine, you went through what we will just call the U.S. Navy Flight School. And at some point, hopefully, I've already got a candidate picked out, but maybe we can do a version of this episode with the Air Force. But for today, we'll talk about Navy. Now, it's not just Navy, right? So obviously the Marine Corps as well.
That's right. Yep.
Coast Guard. Anyone else go through the Navy's training?
We have, when I was down there, this is about 10 years ago, so we had some international students. I remember we had some Italian and some Indian students, officers over there as well. We had the Coasties were there, some Air Force guys and gals, and of course the Marines and,
sure.
and the Navy.
Right. Okay. And that's probably the bulk of it. All right. So let's jump right in. So to lay the groundwork in my own head, when I went through flight training in 1992, from when I was commissioned, I showed up in Pensacola, Florida. The first thing I went through was API, or Aviation Pre-Indoctrination, I think they used to call it, about 6 weeks. And they taught us a little bit of aero, weather, et cetera, but all ground training. Then I went to Milton, right outside of Pensacola there, and flew the T-34 for basic. Then I went to Meridian, Mississippi, flew the T-2C Buckeye for intermediate. It stayed in Meridian, Mississippi for the TA-4J Skyhawk in advanced, which is where I went to the boat for the first time, and then received my wings. And like you, I went to VMFAT 101, except at the time it was up in El Toro, Orange County, California. That was the best year of my life.
I bet.
And had a great time. So what is it like now from when a person is commissioned? I understand they don't call it API anymore. And so give us a quick overview like I just did, and then we'll just jump into each segment of the training.
Yeah, I think what I went through is very similar to what you went through. In the syllabus probably hasn't changed a whole lot in a long time. And it's probably for a good reason, because it's a pretty good syllabus, I think, and it really does produce a good product in the end. But yeah, like you said, the API stuff, or whatever they're calling it these days, focuses a lot on the academic portion, just the basics, understanding the environment you're going to fly in, weather, understanding how your airplane is going to operate, some instrument flight rules, engine, stuff like that, just a good primer. For me as a criminal justice major, to say that I was a bit in over my head was an understatement. Didn't really have any technical background. I have never touched an airplane prior to the military, so I'm surrounded by a lot of very smart people who went to, you know, an Embry-Riddle or had some general aviation experience and were sitting there half asleep in these classes and just doing great on the tests, and I'm sitting there burning the midnight oil just to break even. So that was a bit of an eye-opener for me, and that was out of the gate right off the bat. But in terms of the rest of it, I'd say where our paths probably changed just a little bit, you know, like, yeah, I did the T-34C at Whiting, and then I went down to NAS Kingsville in Texas to fly the T-45 for the bulk of my jet training. We didn't fly the T-2. That got phased out by the time I got into intermediate and advanced training. And by the time I actually got there, we were strictly T-45C model, which was a T-45, but it had a glass cockpit, kind of digital avionics, a heads-up display, much like you would find in an F-18 or a Harrier or a fleet-level aircraft.
Okay. All right, so essentially it's pretty much the same. You've got some ground school, then you've got the three phases, except without the third airplane. So you basically have two aircraft now for at least the jet pilots.
That's right. And,
okay.
And even nowadays, they don't even fly the T-34 down in Whiting or Corpus. It's now the T-6.
Right.
Texan 2, I think it's called. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to fly that. It looks like a great airplane. The guys that have come through to me now that flew that love it. They said it was a good time, and it's a real capable plane.
Okay. So let's start back at the beginning. So first off, criminal justice. So You don't have to be an aerospace engineer or anything else. I mean, I had a friend, Dud, who was on episode, I believe 5 it was, on aerial refueling, who was a music major.
Yep.
So, I mean, they didn't turn you away with a criminal justice major, obviously.
No, it's a great question, you know, because when I grew up, you know, the limited exposure I had to aviation, everyone told me, you know, math, math, math. You have to be a rocket scientist, quite literally a rocket scientist, to be a pilot. And, you know, I'm pretty good at math. I can do it to a pretty decent level, but I am not a mathematician by any stretch of the imagination. So I was a little nervous at how, you know, a liberal arts criminal justice background would fare in a perceived technical mathematic world of aviation. But to my surprise, that background actually benefited me much more, I thought, than a more technical background, in the sense that a lot of the stuff we do in training, someone will quite literally slide a notebook across the table that's about, looks like a 9X phone book, for those of you who can remember what that looks like, a couple inch thick, a lot of pages, really small type, and they'll expect you to know the thing inside and out. And so your ability to consume an enormous amount of information, understand it, conceptualize it, and then translate that into performance in an airplane is really what flight school is all about. And as a criminal justice major, at the time, I was thinking either tracking towards law school to be an attorney or to go to flight school, and obviously picked the right choice there. But that background of just, you know, reading a case file of, you know, a lengthy case file, and just kind of following the breadcrumbs and how that worked out and be able to piece that together, was actually invaluable by the time I got to be a pilot or a flight student, at least.
Sure.
I know quite a few of my friends who had the similar kind of criminal justice history, kind of non-technical background, had that same fear going into the training, but they quickly realized that was a huge benefit of training, and
sure,
it stands true today.
Interesting. So in the case of yourself as a Marine, you have to go to the basic school in Quantico first. We'll skip that for today.
Okay.
And then everybody shows up ready to start what we used to call API, and I think it's called something different now. But even before that, aren't students now, have you heard of this? I think they're giving some of these guys some sort of like Cessna flights or some sort of flights
right
at the beginning.
Yeah, so we
and
did.
What's the idea for that?
We had a program, I believe it was called IFS, and I think it stood for something like Introductory Flight Screening.
Okay.
And it, screening is an interesting term because it was that. The Navy, they wanted to potentially assess your aptitude to fly. How do you do that? For me, I never touch an airplane short of getting on a Delta flight out of Boston to go on vacation, right? So, you know, I'm supposed to get in this plane and function at a, I didn't even know what level I was supposed to operate at, because I didn't know how to do it. But they were just looking to see, is this guy trainable? Can we get him to a certain level? I didn't understand that whole program. I just thought I was going to get 5 to 10 hours in a Cessna and you know, kind of bomb around southern Florida and have a good time, not knowing that it was actually a very serious thing. And there was people that didn't make it through that, which I found out, you know, along the way. You realize, hey, we're so-and-so. And they were like, he didn't, you know, make it through the IFS portion. I was like, wow, I didn't realize that was that serious. And it was really serious.
Wow. I think what they're trying to do, my guess is just see if you're aeronautically adaptable earlier in the process.
Sure.
Because if we send a guy through 6 weeks of ground school, you're not going to find it out.
Right.
Then you get him into the syllabus and he's there with everyone else. And if he's just can't get over air sickness or just for whatever reason is not adaptable, then you find that out sooner.
They're just looking for the basics. You know,
okay,
is this person somewhat athletic, coordinated? Can they talk on the radio? And believe it or not, some people, it's just not in the cards for them, and that's where it comes out. And that's generally the people who don't make it. A very small percentage don't make it through, though.
So a handful of flights, orientation, you're expected to do something just because they want to see if you can put forth the effort and do some basic monkey skills, I'll call them, for lack of anything better. And then, so now we've already touched on it, but then you have some dedicated ground school. So we talked about some theory, right? Aero, weather. At least when I went through, I think they even did like engines, jet engines and whatnot.
Yep, that's right. Yep, jet engines. There was a navigation portion that I remember being stressful. A couple of aerodynamic classes, weather, just kind of the basic, you know, kind of fire hose of academics.
Okay.
Pretty interesting.
So
training.
You went from a guy from Massachusetts who knew nothing basically about flying to, by the end of this story here in a few minutes, a guy who is a combat wingman qualified to rain death and destruction from above in an F-18. So we've got you now through the selection. We've got some basic knowledge in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first thing you could do is go to primary. So like you said, you and I both did that in the T-34 Mentor, little low wing trainer, sit tandem. It's a fun little airplane, actually. These days they fly the T-6. But what happens in basic? I mean, the word kind of gives us the answer, but what are we doing in the first phase of actual flight training?
Yeah, so once you get through all that stuff, which is it's a long road, You'll go through some more academics that are specific to either the T-34 or nowadays the T-6, just so you understand how that plane works and the systems and how the landing gear works, the propeller, all that stuff. And then you'll do some basics, you know, here we call course rules, how to depart the field, how to go out to the various areas to do your aerobatics and your flights, and how to get back to the field, most importantly. Just the basics. And then ultimately, I think that lasted about a month, probably like 6 weeks or so. And then you were ready for your first flight in the airplane. And that was I'll never forget my first flight. I've flown countless flights since then, but there's always a couple that stick out. And that one was certainly one that I remember. And you get what's called an on-wing, which is essentially, it's like a tactical mentor. It's like a big brother that monitors your progress throughout the entire course of training. And you develop a relationship with them, which is great. And you do the majority of your initial flights with your specific on-wing and develop a good relationship, which is great. Luckily for me, I had a fantastic on-wing that I still talk to this day, I should say. And we had a really good time. But essentially, you show up into a briefing room. It's very nerve-wracking because there's a guy sitting across from you that's been in the Marine Corps, been in the Navy or the Air Force or whatever for numerous years. He's been probably deployed a handful of times, maybe been in combat, but has a ton more experience, whatever his background is, than you do. And, you know, quite literally, they can ask you anything and everything about what you're doing that day, anything about the airplane. And it's nerve-wracking. And so we usually brief for about 30 to 60 minutes, and hey, here's a quick safety brief. Here's what we're going to do today. There's always some questions of the day that you're expected to know as a student going into those events. And it's not really a secret what you have to prepare for. So they give you all the information. They tell you what you need to succeed. It's a matter of, again, going back to consuming an inordinate amount of information and being able to use that. It goes back to that because you show up to the briefs. And luckily for me, I was pretty good at memorizing stuff, and I could answer a question, you know, correctly based on what I had read, you know, the night before in somewhat intelligent manner. And it usually worked out pretty good because a lot of times, unfortunately, there's guys and girls that they don't let go out to the airplane after a brief, and they just didn't have their head in the game that day, and they didn't prepare appropriately for whatever reason, and they won't even take you out to the airplane. You just try to go again either the next day or whatever. So
like a ready room down kind of thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's an unsat that isn't even involved, and you haven't even touched the airplane yet. And I think a guy that I was I wasn't really too close for friends with this guy, but we crossed paths a little bit in early stages that I think he had maybe one or two flights, and he was essentially discontinued from training after the second flight. So that definitely got all of our attention.
Well, I think, and you can touch on this skipping ahead now a little bit, being an instructor at a training squadron, I have to think when you sit down with someone, you can probably get a pretty good idea in the first, couple minutes whether they have prepared sufficiently.
Sure.
Because you either have confidence because you know the answer, or you've at least looked at it, and even if it's skipping you at that moment, but or you don't. And this is a full-time job. I mean, you're not doing anything else when you're going through flight school.
Correct.
So I would think that in the case of your friend you were talking about, he probably either had some other distraction or just didn't give it the seriousness it deserved. But I remember when I went through, there was nothing more important to me at that period of my life. And I used to sit in the living room and put a soup spoon in one hand and a salad spoon in the other, and I pretended I was flying.
Because,
you know, you have to be able to say the calls and do certain things with the levers. And to your point, I mean, I had a little bit of flight experience, not very much, but it was also new, and it comes so fast, you got to do what it takes.
I would say, to make a civilian comparison, it's almost like if you took, you know, exam week in college or high school, for example, the preparation for that, but it just doesn't stop. It's nonstop. You take that and you overlay that with, you know, maybe like a playoff sport event, and if you could somehow combine those two every single day, that's essentially flight school, because it's really mentally exhausting, it's physically exhausting, and it's very demanding.
For sure. And as soon as you get a grip on whatever stage you're in, then you move on to the next stage. So for a couple of years, it's nonstop. Now, what are the different phases of basic? In other words, you start, like you said, with a little bit of ground school, and you learn a ton of emergencies. I felt like that was all I learned at first, was how to handle. I thought, teach me how to fly the thing, and then I'll handle emergency. But it seemed like the first thing we did was, okay, if your engine fails, this is what you're going to do.
Sure.
But you start with some basic flying. You said you remember your first flight. I do as well. And what are some of the other phases of flying you do in basic?
Yeah, right off the bat, I believe it was called contact stage, where it's basically you go out to the plane. You just practice taxiing around on the ground, which is everyone kind of laughs at until you try to do it your first time and you're all over the place. And once
like
you
a
find
a driver,
you do, yeah. It's like you're watching like a little kid trying to drive a vehicle, and it can be kind of funny. But eventually, you find the end of the runway, and you take off. And basically, you just get used to flying the airplane. You do some basic aerobatics, some basic stalls, just so you know how to recover from an upset attitude, and some spins, which I remember were mildly an emotional experience for some people.
Emotional.
Well, some people got really sick, unfortunately. I at the time, I would not say that I had a cast iron stomach myself, so I can sympathize with people a little bit there, but some people got really sick, and they just would, you could see them in the ready room just waiting to go on their flight, and they were just not looking forward to it because they knew it was going to have to wait for them. But luckily, I didn't have too much issues with that, and yeah, that's when you really start to enjoy it, and you just go out there and you practice landing, the landing pattern, and getting comfortable repeatedly just over and over again, landing the airplane the way that the Navy wants you to, and it's a good way to land an airplane. And then once from there, I think we went on to the formation stage, which they put another plane out there, and they say, okay, well, I want you to fly probably way too close to another airplane for a while and just follow me around southern Alabama for half an hour, which is kind of cool, though, because everything we do is a building block approach. So right. You start to fly the airplane first, you get comfortable, and then they say, okay, well, let's do something somewhat realistic and fly off a lead now. And you practice the various positions a little bit close, a little bit further back, and some mild kind of maneuvering as a two-ship. And then I think the last thing we did was more of an instrument kind of top-off. So how to operate away from Pensacola in a more realistic FAA-controlled environment in bad weather. So Pensacola, the weather can be okay. You get the afternoon thundershowers, and a lot of times the instrument stuff, quite literally, there's a I think it was a canvas hood we pulled over the front because it wasn't, you just couldn't rely on the weather for training. We made our own bad weather, and you operate just strictly on instruments. You couldn't see out the window.
Yeah.
For me, I got kind of lucky. I remember I did a cross-country from Pensacola up to Chicago Midway in a T-34, which looking back is a terrible idea.
That's a busy airport.
It's a busy airport. And there's some real weather. I think it was in the wintertime, or maybe spring was just around the corner. So the weather wasn't great, and I got some actual, no kidding, instrument time there. And I got yelled at plenty by some very animated controllers up in the Chicago area. You think it sounds like you're talking to Mike Dicka, for about 30 minutes, getting yelled at. And I'm trying to sequence in between 737s, and they're not too happy with me. And I'm just trying to get out of the way and get on deck because this is just my fun meter was pegged.
Yep.
But yeah, and then we pretty much did that, and that was it, I believe, for the basic stuff. It all kind of culminated in the instrument.
Yeah, I remember doing some night flying as well.
Yeah, a little night flying throughout there.
And then they would throw in a lot of the high altitude or low altitude power losses since you were flying a single engine aircraft, so they would constantly mess with you. Hey, what if you lose your engine right now and you'd fly a certain profile? And I remember either you look down and say, ooh, I could land there, so we're good, or, hey, you know what, there's no good place to land, let's pretend to bail out, and of course you stop the simulation there. Yep. And then I think also in the formation stage, at least I was paired with someone, and then by the end, like the last formation flight, there was two of us students that were solos and a third who was a lead, and we'd go out and do some breakup and rendezvous, and then I remember the culmination was the three of us coming in the break at 150 knots, and I go, ooh, that was great. But that's one thing we didn't talk about, too, is here and there, sparsed in after several, of course, dual flights are solo flights, because they expect that you can learn it by yourself in some cases.
That's right. And generally, and this is true for any phase of or type of training you're doing in the Navy, Marine Corps, Hornets, T-34s, it's a progression, crawl, walk, run. And generally towards the end of each kind of phase, mini phase, if you will, that's when the solos generally kick in. So I think and rightfully so, when you first touch an airplane, you do maybe like six or seven or maybe even eight dueled up flights with an instructor before they give you the keys by yourself.
Right.
And as you progress in training and advance to more advanced airplanes, that training kind of requirement shrinks a little bit, so it becomes less and less to solo. But I don't remember doing a three-ship. I do remember a two-ship, though, where I think I was a lead. There was an actual instructor in the back, but we kind of would pogo off each other, where I led the flight for a little bit, and I had no business leading anything at that time. And then my buddy, who certainly had no business leading, we would swap mid-flight.
Right.
And I remember we had, like, we didn't have like an official like score or anything, but there was us and maybe like eight other guys at the time. We had kind of an informal thing going to see who had the best grades, and we all had these outrageous call signs on the radio.
Of course.
That I don't even think I can repeat on this show, but it made it a lot of fun. It was really fun.
Hey, let's talk about grades real quick. So an instructor goes out, you go out, do a FAM 7, let's call it, and you come back, and the instructor has to debrief you, so he tells you the goods of the others, and then there's some sort of grade system. I mean, I guess a lot like what, academics? We need a way to just capture and rank people?
Yeah, it is. It's kind of unique. The whole structure is very unique, because what happens is, again, there's never any question of what you're going to be graded on. So you know walking into the event, I'm going to be graded on these 8 items. So you know right off the bat what they're going to look at. And then what they do is they determine that an average student for this whatever flight they're on, an average kind of outcome are these grades. And generally there's about between 5 to 10 different individual grades you give a student. And what they do is they say, okay, if you and they tell you, here's the average of this event, and basically we have 1 or 2 above average, 1 or 2 below for each kind of individual little kind of facet they're looking at. Mm-hmm. And at the end, you kind of tally up how that works out. So what ends up happening is when you get done with training, they take a look at where you rank in relation to, say, the last 100 or last 200 students, and that's where you ultimately end up kind of on the pecking order, how that works out wise. So you know when you come out of an event, you know exactly what you did and what you did right and what you did wrong, and you know exactly where you stood grade-wise. So there's never, again, no secret or anything, but it is a fact of life, and sometimes it can get – it's a big distraction for some people, just that kind of that there's always a you have to perform, and it's always kind of a nagging voice in your ear that you have to do well here, because you never know when it's going to be your last flight if it comes to that. But generally, people do pretty well. It motivates people, and again, there has to be some kind of a pecking order, because ultimately, in the end, when you go to select what aircraft or what pipeline you want to go to, the grades are probably the primary driving factor there.
So the grade sheet would have a column for average, and then maybe to the right, above average, to the left, below average, and then probably a column or at least a spot to say unsat. So in other words, if you went out and did something either dangerous or dumb or not even close to the standard, they could terminate the flight, come back, and that's like a down or a refly. And it's just their way to document if someone's really struggling.
That's right,
so,
yeah.
Okay. All right, so you already touched on it. So at the end of basic, then you come to your first fork in the road. Mm-hmm. And at that point, they rank everyone, at least in my timeline, I think there was maybe 4 or 5 of us was all that were finishing that particular week. And they ranked us and they asked us what we wanted. And I think at the time the options were jets, maritime, I think they called it, for like P3s, and then helicopters. Mm-hmm. Is that pretty much still the case?
That's what I remember, yeah.
Okay. Then you put in your request and they weigh your desire against the needs of the Navy, which of course takes precedence.
That's right.
And then I don't know about you, I can remember being brought in and, hey, congratulations, Ensign Aiello, you got jets.
Well, I remember we had the CO asked us if we wanted to do it individually, just like that, like you described. I didn't really care either way, or if they wanted to do it collectively as a group. And it was me and I think it was me and 2 other Marines. There was maybe 8 Navy ensigns and maybe 2 or 3 Coast Guardsmen. Mm-hmm. And they, for whatever reason, they decided to do it as a group. So we were sitting in a room, you know, just like this conference room.
Raise your hand if you want helicopters.
Conference room style, just sitting around. Yeah. And the CEO was like, okay, like I have the, you know, he pulls out a piece of paper. He's like, I have the list right here. You guys ready to go? So I'm, and he did it alphabetically. So I'm Walsh, I'm W, so I'm naturally I'm the last person to go. And, you know, just like you said, you set your dream sheet. I want to fly jets. I want to fly helicopters. I want to go here. You know, and you just rank it. I think there was like 5 or 6 choices. And they match what you want with what the Marine Corps wants or the Navy. And the Navy and the Marine Corps needs always trump what you want.
Of
and,
course.
You know, so you just pray for the best. I really wanted to fly jets. Just try to do my best and hope for the best. And when the CO was going down the list, every single person got helicopters. So there was... No, math in public, 8 plus 3, 8, about 15, 14 people, and I'm the last to find out what I was going to get. You know.
So you see the writing on the wall here.
So exactly. So I'm kind of sitting there just in the back of the room just waiting, and, you know, he's going down the list. Aiello, helicopters, Baker, helicopters, you know, Charlie, this. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And I had made my peace. You know, I was excited to do anything. I just was just ready to go in the Marine Corps. You want me to fly helicopters? Hey, let's do it.
Yeah,
you
want to
fly cargo planes? Like, hey, let's do it. So. But some people were really, they had their one thing they wanted to fly, and that was it. And people, I don't know what it was, but the Navy guys that week or that selection class, there was a lot of guys that wanted jets, and none of them got jets, and they were devastated.
I can imagine.
And I felt really bad for these guys, but I didn't know what I was going to get yet. So I was sitting in the back like, hey, sorry, guys, you know, I feel for you, but like, W, here we go. And I think the CEO said something like, okay, Walsh, lastly, T2. And I'm like, T2? I'm like, I don't even know what that is. I'm like, They waited the last day to like kick me out of here. Like, yeah, what does exactly. that even mean?
Submarines?
I don't even know. So T2 was Training Wing 2 in Kingsville. Training Wing 1 was Meridian,
right.
T-45s to track jets. T2, Training Wing 2 in Kingsville. And every single person at that table just, I thought they were going to like mutiny and rip me to pieces. And I was just like, I kind of put my hands up and, you know, and internally I was, you know, beyond excited. But I fell for those guys who didn't get what they wanted, and that's how we found out. And interestingly enough, there was the other squadron, I think it was VT-6, which is another squadron in down in Pensacola. I had a look at their list, so I knew the guys, and this was when I selected, it was about 8 in the morning, and I knew that they weren't doing theirs until like 2 in the afternoon that day. So my roommate was in VT-6, and I went over there and I looked at their list, so I knew what he got before he did.
Oh, wow.
And I called him up, and I, you know, I told him what I got and everything, and jets, and he was all excited, and I was like, hey, you know... hey, good luck this afternoon, man. Like, we'll meet up later on, but yeah, best of luck. And he's like, oh, thanks. Like, do you know something I don't know? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't want to ruin it for you, but like, whatever. I'll catch you later. And knowing full well, he got T1, which is Meridian. So he was going jet, which was his first choice. So I was just kind of give him a little rub
a little
there.
Scare.
And we met up that night, went out pretty big down in Pensacola.
Sure.
But he, interesting enough, that same guy, he's up at he's a reservist now up at 101. As an F-18 instructor, probably.
Oh,
yeah,
very cool.
He was my roommate down in flight school. We stayed tight. We're still tight to this day.
Awesome.
And it was a good story.
Yeah, that's cool. No,
yeah.
I like that. It wasn't RCO who did my announcement, but it was somebody probably in the training or whatever office. And I remember him looking at me. He said, "Well, how would you feel if you got P3s patrols?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd be disappointed, but I'd be all right, I guess."
Yeah.
He goes, "Oh, you don't have to worry about it. You got jets."
Oh, jeez.
I'm like, "Well, thanks, but okay."
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, I mean, it's funny the things that stick in your mind, and those are pivotal days, of course. So, all right, so you get done with that. You celebrate, in our case, and then you go off to intermediate. So you went down to Kingsville, Texas.
Yep.
Right down in the bottom of the state there. I didn't go far. I just went over to Meridian, Mississippi. Now, when you show up, you know how to fly an airplane, but... now we're going to take those skills and teach you how to fly a jet.
Exactly. So very similar kind of crawl, walk, run approach to the training at T-45s. You know, a lot of academics up front, you learn the jet, you learn how it ticks and what makes it go. And then the training syllabus is almost identical, actually, right off the bat. You go out there just with an instructor in your back seat, and you have an on-wing, and you just do the same thing. You go up and practice, aerobatics in the jet, how to land, how to take off, do some basic instrument approaches, and then you solo, just like you did in the T-34, although now you go from flying around at, 90 knots, 100 knots, to cruising at 250 plus. So
right.
it's the speed and the rate that things happen is just exponential compared to what you came from. So that's an eye-opener. And it takes a while to get used to just the pace of the rapid pace in a jet vice a propeller plane.
Right. Now, and when we went through, the T-34 systems-wise was pretty basic. I guess the T-6 guys now, though, have hydraulics and ejection seats and mm-hmm. heads-up displays, so they've already learned all that. But mm-hmm. I remember learning the T-2 in my case, and probably same for you in the T-45. Suddenly, you're learning about all these newer and more complex systems.
Yeah.
And so that adds an element to it. Plus, you have to, like I said earlier, go back and do some of the water survival and, because of ejection seats, so you have to do a little trainer there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like you said, everything just happens faster.
Yeah.
And so you've got to be ahead of the aircraft, as you always should be anyway, but now even more so. And you still learn some of those instrument flying lessons or rules, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And then at least in T2, and I assume it was true in the T-45 as well, now, whereas the T-34, it's kind of a basic airplane meant to be flared to land. The T2, in my case, probably same for you in the T-45, almost every landing now was a preparation landing for eventually going to the boat.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's only so many training opportunities you get, no matter where you go, but especially at that stage in your career. And eventually, probably besides, some basic air-to-ground introduction and some basic air-to-air training introduction, the biggest difference or the biggest addition in the T-45 syllabus is you go to the aircraft carrier. You go day VFR to the carrier by yourself, which is incredible. You don't have a lot of time, and it happens faster than we all expected to. So every single time you come out of the break or come out of an instrument approach, you're practicing a Navy-graded to the carrier type approach that we call an FCLP landing.
Field carrier landing practice.
Exactly right.
Okay.
And to the point where they'll have the dimensions of the carrier painted on the runway.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have the meatball on the left-hand side, just like where you were to determine if you're high on the glide slope, you're
right.
low. And that's exactly what's out on the boat. You know, obviously the runway's not moving like the boat is, but you're every single time you're just building rep after rep after rep. That ultimately culminates if you go on the boat to the carrier hooked down for the first time.
Right. Now, that happens in the advanced stage.
It's a little bit down the road.
Now, yep. You and I were talking before off tape about nowadays you went to what squadron were you in?
I was in VT-22.
So you went to VT-22, began in basic, but then at some point someone just waved their hand in front of you and said, you're now in advanced. Is that right?
Yes.
Because I went from one squadron to another in Mississippi.
I think it changed a little bit from when you went to when I went, because there was never an official transition for me.
Okay.
From, I believe it was called intermediate up front. Intermediate was first, and then it became advanced.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was transparent. It was all the same thing. And the advanced, the biggest difference there was we started doing air-to-ground. You know, we started doing practice bombing runs out in El Centro in California. We did some basic low-level, one-ship, two-ship low-level flights out in the desert, armed reconnaissance-type type missions. We did some air-to-air, basic BFM, basic fighter maneuvers, kind of like dogfight practice, and then in the boat. So, but for me, and I think in the past from you guys, it was a different plane up front, and then you basically went to advanced. And I do remember, though, in the Navy, this is only specific to the Navy, there was a mini selection between intermediate and advanced that everyone went down to Kingsville that tracked jets at that point, but there was a selection in between an intermediate and advanced where you either went E2C2, which was the COD, the carrier onboard delivery, or the airborne warning platform.
Mm-hmm.
You tracked that way, or you kept going on the strike that ultimately ended up in the Hornet platform.
Okay.
So that was kind of a mini selection process, just unique to the Navy. Marines didn't do that. At about the halfway point. So probably a little bit different for those guys, a little bit more stressful. And that occurred, I believe it was just basically after your kind of basic instrument, basic familiarization, basic formation.
Sure.
They made an assessment to say, hey, the best guys that could fly form the best and could control their airplane the best kind of track towards the F-18 or the strike. And then for whatever reason, I wasn't privy to the criteria.
Sure.
This is what we all suspected. And some other great guys went over and did E2C2s and came down and lived in Coronado and had a great
sure,
career and,
yeah.
and loved it.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, we had a slightly different track when I went through. They knew that when they finished basic. So that was a whole different platform. But they flew the T2, which we did as well.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, getting back to the intermediate, you show up, you start flying a jet, and then towards the end of it, and in my case, I switched, like I said, squadrons and started flying the A4 Skyhawk. Now you're getting a little taste of what you're going to do in the FRS, you begin employing the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So to your point, you do a little bit of air ground. Did you guys drop anything from the T-45? I got to drop Mark 76s.
We did. We dropped Mark 76s.
Okay.
Yep, same.
Did it have a gun or anything?
It didn't have a gun.
Okay.
And I don't think we practiced even simulated.
Did you not? We had a gun in the A4. It worked about a third of the time. I remember shooting it a few times, and it was cool
nice.
When you did. And even in the T2, we did an air-to-air gun pattern.
Nice.
Almost like shooting a banner.
Yeah,
in fact,
we never...
I think they would actually bring the banner out.
Okay.
But
we didn't do that.
They took
that
away.
We didn't get any of that.
It probably wasn't necessary, but it was interesting because it made you a better pilot in so much as the pattern was very specific.
Sure.
And the banner aircraft was moving. So you had to get to what they called high perch and then roll in and then do the track and then come off. It was fun.
I wish we got to do that.
Sounds fun. Yeah. So anyway, then, like I said, then when you get to the advanced stage, now you start doing some of the actual employment, and then it all culminates with going to the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go out daytime only.
Daytime only.
And you get, what, 10 landings and, what, 4 or 6 touch-and-goes?
I remember doing about 4 touch-and-goes and maybe 10 or 12 traps.
Okay.
Was what we got. And I can't remember exactly, but I think we broke it up into basically 2 sessions, for lack of a better word. That I think it was, you know, you get 1 or 2 touch-and-goes to kind of warm up a little bit, kind of get in the swing of things, and then we did 6 full trap landings, and then we kind of did that rinse and repeat the next day. It was a 2-day evolution.
Right, and then at some point they would sideline you and put more gas in you, and then off you go. And I think we've talked about before on this show, you don't have an instructor with you generally because, frankly, they're just not crazy enough. But it's also a trial by fire for the students. I mean, it's clear that when you're going out there by yourself, you either make this happen or, you know, so be it. And at least for naval aviators, that is a requirement, just like form flying or night flying or aero or anything else.
That's right.
Aerobatics, that is. Now, and you don't always do that at the very, very end. It's not necessarily the capstone because they have to coordinate. We don't have a training carrier anymore like we used to 25, 30 years ago. So when the Carl Vinson or the Abraham Lincoln is available, then suddenly the squadron gets a call. You put your CQ shop together and they say, hey, let's take whoever's ready, right? They have to be past a certain phase.
That's right. Yep.
And obviously some guys could be done and just waiting, mm-hmm. but and you go out and it isn't always the last thing you do, but it's usually pretty close.
Yeah, they try to do it when it makes sense and when the boat's available, really.
Right.
And it can really it can cause a bit of a train wreck in the overall syllabus because everything else gets put on hold while we have an opportunity. And rightfully so, the weather has to be good conditions. You know, the sea state has to be fairly low, you know, for people's first time doing it. And sometimes you get out there and you get off, you know, I did mine off Jacksonville and out off of Cecil. And sometimes the weather doesn't cooperate. And, you know, the CQ shop puts this whole evolution together and it gets weather canceled. We had one group of guys and gals, it got canceled 3 times in a row.
Oh, gosh.
And it just added so much overhead to their training. Yeah. But, it just, you know, nothing you can do about that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that is what makes us naval aviators. And then you come back from that, you finish whatever you got left, and then graduation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and the culmination of all this is the Wings of Gold.
That's right. Yeah, I think the last flight I remember doing was it was like a 2v1 ACM flight, which is kind of neat, where it's basically you and a lead are going two against another bandit out there by himself, flown by another instructor pilot, and you come back into the overhead, you know, as a three ship, and your buddies are waiting for you with the fire hoses and the water balloons and everything, and your family's out there, you know, my wife was there and everything, and it's a really cool event. You come out of the jet, and everyone just soaks you down with water.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Gives you a pat in the back, and then, you know, hopefully, you generally, I think we tried to select, or we winged, you know, basically the week we finished up, so it worked out pretty good.
Yep, that is a great feeling, because it's the culmination of a lot of hard work for a long time, you bet. I remember that as well, and she wasn't my wife at the time, but she is now, was there to wing me, and they give you, I think what we did was like the soft wings. They would give you a patch with a for your flight suit,
mm-hmm.
but then until you actually had the ceremony, at the time it used to be at the chapel there in Meridian, then you couldn't actually wear them on your uniform.
Oh, yeah. Anyway. No, I remember our CO came out, and he kind of soft-winged us, and that was really cool. And I remember kind of like, I was like, is everyone looking at me? Because I'm definitely just like kind of awkwardly staring down at these, you know, shiny
wings
on my chest.
Excuse me, I need to go stand in front of a mirror for a little while.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just going to be in the corner looking at myself for a second here.
Well, we're pilots. We do that anyway, right?
Yeah, and you know, everyone sees you do it, and it's like, you know, you're going to do it tomorrow when you do it, and sure enough. But
it, I mean, it's a great feeling because it's the culmination, like I said, of a lot of hard work. But that's not the end. I mean, so
now
you are a winged aviator,
mm-hmm.
and you are able to go from there. Then, and in my case, we had more than just the F-18. We were able to pick back then, I want to say, F-14, S-3, EA-6B, Prowler, and F-18. So there was at least 4 to choose from.
Okay.
These days, it's mostly just various flavors of an F-18. But there again was, just like jets or not, mm-hmm. was another, at least for us, checkpoint. Now, I guess for the Marine Corps, when you went through, was there still Prowlers? Was that still an option?
There was. So I remember you selected a platform and in the coast as well. So for me, my list was something like Hornets West Coast out of Miramar,
mm-hmm.
Hornets East Coast, which is Beaufort, South Carolina. And then there was same thing, Harriers East Coast, Harriers West Coast, Hornets Japan.
Oh, yeah, Harriers, yeah.
Prowlers, which were only East Coast at the time. They're at sundowning right now, so that's not even an option. And you just rank your platform with your coast. Nowadays, the F-35 is in the mix, so there's guys and gals coming out of that, going right from a T-45 right into an F-35, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
That was an option for us back then. And just like you did out of, you know, Pensacola, they just match what your service needs with what you selected or requested. And kind of the cool thing, I remember we had what's called a senior Marine, which was generally a fairly experienced guy who kind of headlined all the Marines in the training command. So there's always a CO and the XO in the chain of command.
Right.
But there was a senior Marine, which is kind of, he just kind of was like your big brother to all the Marines. And he had his pulse on a lot of things, but one of the biggest ones was kind of selection. So he knew you know, he would take your personality into account. He'd take your grades into account. He'd take your selection preferences into account and kind of weigh those with what the Marine Corps needed. And he tried to basically just try to put a personality instead of just a name to a number. And I think, just looking back, it worked out pretty darn well.
Yeah.
People generally, you know, there's always people that are unhappy with what they get, but which is just an unfortunate, you know, fact of life mm-hmm. in naval aviation. But most of the people, I think, ended up going where they were supposed to go and no matter where you end up, everyone ends up loving what they do and flourishing. So I think this system works pretty good.
Okay.
It was designed to fly fast and at treetop level, carrying 24 nuclear weapons. Today, it bristles with smart bombs and guided missiles. The B-1 bomber, called the Bone by those who fly and maintain it, is the most heavily armed bomber ever built. Sleek and powerful, the Bone remains a mainstay of American air power 50 years after its first flight. Hey everyone, this is Ken Katz, call sign Primetime, and my book, The Supersonic Bone, A Development and Operational History of the B-1 Bomber, tells the true story of this magnificent airplane. In this book, you'll read stories told to me by those who were there and see lots of great photos of the bone. Anyone with an interest in modern military aircraft will enjoy reading The Supersonic Bone. Available through the usual online retailers and aviation booksellers. Pick up your copy today.
All right, so in the case of F-18 pilots, then you show up to one of the FRSs, Fleet Replacement Squadrons. We have VMFAT-101 in San Diego. We have VFA-106 in Oceana, Virginia Beach, and VFA-122 in Lemoore. And I believe you guys still go to all of them, or do you only go to 101 now for Marines?
From my understanding right now is we have Marine instructors over at let's see, where they are right now. They're at 106, I believe. I don't think there's Marine students there anymore. We haven't had anyone up at 122 up at Lemoore in a bit, although we're about to start to send F-35 Charlie Marines up to that program.
Well, that's going to go to VFA-125.
Oh, is it? Okay. Yeah, one of the two. Okay, gotcha.
And 122 probably doesn't have Hornets anymore.
They're strictly Super Hornets.
Okay, yeah.
Only. So right now, and I'm sure there may be, you know, onesie twosies Marine students at 106, but I think that's pretty much coming to an end. So 101 is basically for Marines at least.
Okay. Either way, the syllabus is mostly the same. So you show up at an FRS, let's say an F-18 squadron in this example, and what are you doing there?
So you show up, you're a winged aviator, so that's kind of neat. That's a bit of a different, certainly an upgrade from past flight school experiences. But, you know, like you said earlier, with that increased level of responsibility, your expectations increase as well. So you're expected to conduct yourself more professionally than you have in the past. We know that you don't know how to fly an F-18, but you've been around the Navy, the Marine Corps for a couple years now. So you've been in a couple squadrons now, so you know how to act in a squadron. You know how to conduct yourself in a ready room and, you know, speak to instructors and COs and exos, stuff like that. And basically, we just kind of start again. We go from the crawl, walk, run. A lot of academics up front. In my case, we'll teach you the ins and outs of the F-18, the A through D model, the Legacy Hornet. And then we'll get you into what we do is EP sims. Just again, just like to your point earlier, I feel like all we do was EPs, but rightfully so, because, you know, especially nowadays, our equipment's aging, and every single guy that's been around for more than a year or two in the Hornet has had something. Probably not super significant, but at least on the mild side, that required some kind of attention from him as a pilot in terms of emergency procedures. So we do a whole lot of, I think it's maybe 14 or 15 simulators dedicated. So one simulator will be specifically for the avionics, for the electrical EPs.
Like a show and tell almost.
Just a little bit of a show and tell, but there's, you know, there's certain emergencies that have a memory item that you have to just know what to do in this case. And it's bullet point, do step one, three, two, three, four, five, you know, in order, and then pull out, you know, a book that kind of backs you up and fills in the details. You know, hydraulics, engine emergencies, stuff like that. And we put you through the gamut. And then ultimately, before we let you go in the airplane, we have what's called a safer solo sim where we do a lot of ground emergencies. So you start all in the simulator. Everything's off. You practice turning the jet on. You know, you'll have some engine fires, some other various ground emergency stuff that'll just kind of test your decision making. We'll go out to the runway. We'll do a couple abort scenarios, a low speed abort, a high speed abort when you're cruising down the runway and something very significant happens that you know, just to test your decision-making. Am I going to take this airplane flying? Am I going to abort on the deck? And that's a bit of an exposure event just to show guys and gals what's out there and what could happen to them. And then we'll go up and do some basic aerobatics. It's kind of a scenario-based thing that ultimately culminates in hopefully you bringing the simulated airplane back to the field and recover in one piece. So,
but you've showed the instructors that you have done the study and you know all the, you said EP, so that's emergency procedure. So you know basically how to handle just about anything that can happen to this aircraft per guidance that's been given to us, to your point. In some cases, rote memorization, step one, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's within reason. You know, the scenarios, they're realistic. And a lot of times we program the sim to do what people have seen in real life. And we tell the guys after that, hey, that what you saw there, that actually happened to Jello on this day, and this is what happened. And that really gets people's attention because instead of just some, you know, arbitrary scenario, this stuff really happened.
Right.
So you need to have a general idea of how to aviate, navigate, find your way home and talk to the right people, you know, execute the appropriate kind of crew resource management, CRM skills that we harp on daily. You know, whether you're by yourself, there's always someone on a radio you can talk to back home. You always have a flight lead. You always have, you know, San Diego FAA, air traffic controllers you can help out. There's all sorts of resources that are out there to help you get your airplane back on deck. And we just try to make sure we kind of beat that into their head so they know that's there.
Right. So, and that's a great point, because we're not just teaching people how to monkey skill fly an airplane. We're teaching them how to be pilots.
We're teaching them how to think.
And in this case, in the FRS, we're teaching them how to be F-18 pilots, and how to think, how to have situational awareness. And then, as we'll get to here in a moment, how to employ the airplane, right? So now we have some simulators to prep folks for some of the air-to-surface weapons that we use, because, frankly, we can't let everyone expend all the ordnance. It's just not practical, as well as air-to-air, for that matter. But we show them air-to-surface. We show them air-to-air. We do aerial refueling. Now, that we do for real.
We do, yep.
And then some close air support and some dogfighting and some large force, maybe not large force, but at least some, what, two versus two or more, or four versus even?
We'll get all the way up to 4V. We'll get as many as we can, really. 4V4, 4V8 sometimes, depending.
So four good guys and eight bad guys.
Yeah, just if we can line it up and make the training work. So
air-to-air employment. And then, again, the culmination is what? Back to the boat?
Yeah, the boat. So that can happen anywhere, really, in between the air-to-ground and air-to-air phase. We try to do it at the end just because that's when the students are the most experienced, and they're kind of, they've seen, you know, they have basically maybe 80 hours in the jet, which is not a lot, but it's better than sending a guy with 50 hours to the boat. So every hour counts at that stage in the training. And then we do the same thing. We spin them up the CQ shop. We get them back out to do the FCLPs like we talked about. We have the same setup at Miramar where the carrier box dimensions are painted on the runway and the IFALS lens is on the side, and we practice, you know, doing this like we're going to do it out in the carrier.
Except unlike in the T-45, when you only went in the daytime, what happens in the F-18 now?
Well, in the F-18, you go out in the daytime, and it's great, and you're like, I remember doing this. This is awesome. Like, you know, it's just an impressive thing to be a part of. And then you're like, oh, this is great. I'm just going to get something to eat. And they're like, I don't think so, because we're going to go back out tonight and do it at night. And that's, to be honest, that can be downright terrifying. And thankfully, as a Marine, I was not a boat Marine, so I don't have a whole lot of experience in the boat. So I give a lot of credit to you guys to doing that day in and day out, or night in and night out, I should say, because that is something when you line up behind a boat at night and you know what an aircraft carrier looks like, but you see, like, a handful of lights just bobbing in the water, and you don't see an aircraft carrier, but you know that's it.
All right.
That's something.
You know, it always cracked me up. I think in the FRS, you're supposed to get, what, 10 day and 6 night to qualify. And for the Navy guys, to your point, you know, we'd go out and get, I should check my logbook, but I think I have close to 300 night landings. And it was always fun to meet a major or a lieutenant colonel who had like 12 because he got 6 once and then maybe he went back later after a staff tour and got 6 again. But then, went to a shore squadron.
It was unique, though, because I remember, whereas in T-45s, they really do hold your hand in that whole evolution, and probably rightfully so, and to the point where when you come to the ship in a T-45, you're just following your flight lead, and he will set you up in pretty good parameters, you know, distance from the boat and speed and altitude, that you can make, at least for that first one, that you can make a pretty good pass at the boat, and then the rest is up to you. F-18s, I think someone slid like an index card across the table with a lat long, latitude, longitude, the location of the boat, and they said, I'll see you on button 13. I'm at North Island by myself, and there's this like lonely looking F-18 out in the apron, and I'm like, where is everybody else? And they're like, that's it. We'll see you. Just see go. You on button 13. And I'm like, oh my God, like, okay. And it's sink or swim. I remember I get out overhead the ship, and I was the day before, or 2 days before, I was out there, and there was just, you know, planes everywhere. It was like a World War I movie. You know, there was everywhere. There's planes.
Because all the FRSs show up, right?
Everyone. The guys from Lemoore came down. Yeah. I think we had a couple guys from the East Coast came over. So it was great. So at least, you know, I didn't know what was going on, but there was company there, and that was familiar. I knew if every F-18 nose was kind of pointed in one direction. If I just kind of did that, I'd at least blend in. When I went back out there this time, there was nobody, not a single plane, and it was about 8 in the morning, and the TACAM, which is the navigation device you use to try to work your way around it and get from point A to point B, the TACAM on the ship wasn't working that well. It was intermittent, so that wasn't really helping, and I knew kind of the general direction where the boat was, and they gave me this inaccurate, you know, coordinate, but somehow, by the grace of God, I found the boat, and I get over the head, and I was by myself. And I was like, oh my God, this is not good. And I could see it was the initial, I think the morning ops haven't began yet. And so I could see all the Navy enlisted guys and gals on the flight deck getting ready to start trapping jets. And I was so low, I could just see them, just their heads just following me. I'm just making laps at above them, you know, a couple thousand feet. But I can see them just kind of tapping their feet and kind of leaning up against gear and equipment. They're all waiting for me, you know, to land this jet, and I could feel them like, all right, Junior, come on, let's go. Everyone's watching. The whole carriage is sitting there, and the air boss gets on, and he had this real southern drawl from, you know, Georgian drawl, which is great. And he was like, "Hey, you know, hey son." He goes, "Well, why don't you come on in and hook down first pass?" Which is generally you take a couple laps and right. You do a touch and go, and you just kind of get the butterflies out, and then you drop the hook and start keeping score. The boss wanted me to come down and play for real right off the bat, and I was like, "Oh my god!" Like everyone is watching. This is like day two. I have no idea what I'm doing, and I came around, you know, hooked down first pass, and I can't remember what wire I caught, but I trapped. Got some gas, and my knees were shaking, and they threw some gas in the jet, and they blasted me off, and I went out there. And I think I was like, I don't remember too many other people out there, so it was kind of neat. I had a whole carry to myself, and I'm just, you know, doing laps in the pattern, taking traps, and it was surreal. It was great. I'll never forget that.
That is cool. Well, you can't pay for that.
It's great.
That's a lot of cost for that thing running around just for you, but I'm sure someone else showed up before long or they were taking a break.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. All right, so you finish the CQ. You might finish the rest of your syllabus, and then what happens at the end of the FRS? I mean, you're not getting winged, mm-hmm. but you're at least probably going to find out what squadron you're going to?
Yeah, so somewhere in there, generally for me, what I do now with the students coming through, or the RACs, replacement air crews, we call them, mm-hmm. when they get about, you know, a couple weeks out from completion, I start to talk with the whatever higher headquarters they're going. So whether they're staying here at Miramar or they're going out to the East Coast in Beaufort or to Japan, I'll start to talk with those guys, and they'll have an idea of, they kind of do a powwow of their own and divvy up based on manning requirements where people are going to go. So generally, as a training officer, I have a heads up of where guys are going to go, and I try not to even really show my cards there and let them, just so they don't get distracted and just get ahead of themselves. But when you complete, we generally do what's called a patching, which is kind of neat, and we have a up at 101, we have a heritage room in the squadron that has... There's a lot of lineage, a lot of family members in the past that have come through 101, and we have their pictures up on the wall, and it's, you know, it's just a really cool place to christen newly minted pilots. So basically what we do is if the RAC is staying here at Miramar, I'll call up the squadron they're going to if they're home, and I'll invite them over to the heritage room, and the whole squadron comes over, and they're just like great whites just waiting for this little guppy to get out of the, kick them out of the boat. And they'll come over and they'll welcome them into their squadron. Sure. And, you know, we'll have their class advisor. We'll say a couple funny stories or just, you know, some things that came up along the way. It's kind of like a roast.
Sure.
All in good fun. And generally their squadron that's receiving them will welcome there. So it's a really good kind of culmination of everything.
Yeah, for sure. And you made the comment if they're home. So a lot of times squadrons are deployed.
Yeah, and that's what happened to me when I was a student at 101. So there was only one squadron at the time at Miramar. I was slated to stay there, and there was only one squadron home. So I was like, well, that pretty much narrows it down. I guess I kind of know where I'm going. And I, you know, in typical Cat 1 RAC, I was 100% wrong, and I had no idea what was going on. And I remember my CO pulled me in his office, you know, probably a day or two after we finished, and you know, I had like a mag patch on an air group because they didn't know where to send me.
Right.
And this patch was terrible looking. And yeah, it's not terrible. It's an all right patch, but it's not a gun squadron. I wanted a Marine gun squadron on my chest, and I didn't get that. And I was like kind of disappointed. And he said, "Hey, you know, how do you feel about deploying?" And I'm like, "I don't necessarily feel great about it. It's, you know, it's what we're here to do, right?" And he's like, "No, I mean, like, how do you feel about deploying in like 2 weeks?" And I was like, 2 weeks? I'm like, wow, that's pretty close. I'm like, I don't what the hell? He said, "What are you talking about, sir? What's going on?" And he said, you know, there's a squadron that we're thinking about sending you and another guy to, but they're currently over in CENTCOM out in the Middle East. What do you think about that? And I was like, oh, absolutely. I'm like, let's do this.
Nice.
So 2 weeks turned into, I think that was more about, you know, 4 to 6 or so real time, which is okay because we just had our first baby as all this is going on in the background. So my wife, I'm trying to relay this to her, and she's less than thrilled. Just, you know, with the first kid, and we have no idea what we're doing with, you know, being parents and stuff, and the CO wants to send me overseas, but it's something that I relay to the RACs to this day, you know, to take this deadly serious, because quite honestly, your life depends on it.
Sure.
And the second you're finished here at 101 with us, you're expected to operate, you know, at an appropriate level of an inexperienced F-18 pilot, but you're expected to operate your airplane in a lethal way based on what you've learned in the last year and a half. And so I can see that it sometimes goes over guys and gals' heads a little bit, and I can tell that they don't really believe me sometimes. And then I tell them that story. I'm like, hey, I was overseas within a month of completing here. And, you know, I was certainly not tasked with doing really anything remotely important when I got to my fleet squadron, when I met the Black Knights overseas. But they expected me to be able to start an airplane and find my lead and stay in relatively good position and not be a nuisance and right. not require, you know, extra handholding. And that's what I did.
Yep.
And it served me well through my time there.
For sure. Because then you get there, you're theoretically a combat wingman, but you're still pretty green. And then they're going to hone you into a lethal warfighter at that point and their specific way to their squadron.
That's right.
All right, so let's take a step back. How many hours do you get in each phase of training? So, for example, I ended up with, I want to say, about 100 in the T-34, about 90 in the T-2, and about 110 in the A-4. And then I want to say
right.
I ended up with about 100 in the FRS as well. So is that about the same?
Yeah, I think I was actually looking at my logbook the other day. I think I got about 100 hours or so in the T-34.
Okay.
T-45, I actually, before I got selected to fly Hornets, they were really short on instructors, and they asked me to stick around for an extra year to be what's called a surgrad.
Oh, yeah.
So I didn't even know what that was at the time, and it was me and two of my really good buddies, and again, we're in the CO's office standing tall, and he looks at, you know, one guy's like, you're going to Hornets in Beaufort, first choice, elated. You're going to Prowlers, his first choice, elated, and you're staying here, and I was like,
you're doing it again.
And I didn't even know because it wasn't even an option. And he explained what it was. So I stuck around for an extra year to be to be an instructor. So for me, I think I came out of there. By the time I got to Miramar, I was sitting at maybe close to 400 hours.
Sure, but you were probably flying twice a day.
I was flying, you know, but it was about 100 to, you know, call about 110 as a student. Mm-hmm. And then I was flying 2-3 times a day, five days a week for a year straight.
Will a student fly twice a day?
Sometimes, yeah. And there's certain rules to limit how many, you know, training events guys and gals can do. But sometimes I can do. We'll do like what's called an out and in, where we'll take off, we'll do our training flight, land at a different airport, get some gas, maybe a bite to eat, and then launch off, do the same, or do a different mission and land back at home plate. So
okay. And then we talked a little bit about simulators before, but is it still pretty much the progression that you get some ground school, whether it's instructed or on your own, right? You could be sitting at some computer-based training.
Yep.
And then generally you hop in a simulator, and then you generally fly after that. So kind of book, simulator, airplane.
Yeah, it is. And that's, you know, that's day one at T-34 is kind of rinse and repeat. And you'll do that all the way up until you get to the – and even in the fleet, once you become a fleet aviator – you'll do that, not so much the academic portion, but generally we'll run you through a sim or two prior to an actual flight just to build up some reps. So, and it leads to better training when we get in the airplane.
Yeah. It's like batting practice before the
exactly,
game.
Exactly, yep, exactly.
Okay. And then what about other jobs while you're in flight school? I mean, are they making you stand duty, or do you have a division you're in charge of, the guys in corrosion shop or anything like that?
I think the only job, if you want to call it that you get as a student is the duty officer.
Okay.
So I remember in T-34 is you didn't really have anything, and rightfully so. So 100% of your time is devoted to learning how to fly at a basic level. T-45s, you sometimes get slated to kind of help run the flight schedule for a couple hour chunks of a day. So, I mean, that's maybe 5% of your time. So still 95%, maybe even higher than that, you're devoted to being a flight student.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing up at 101 or the Hornet FRS. We have our students help out on the duty desk and help the IP who's running the flight schedule for that day kind of assist him and do his duties there. But again, we try to limit that to no more than once a month. So that's, again, a relatively small tax, which is totally different from when you get to the fleet. And that catches people by surprise,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember when I was in T-34s, I think it was that you had like an instructor who was the ODO, maybe, the operations duty officer, kind of had the big bubble on things, and then his little right-hand man was the student whose turn it was to be on the duty desk that day, and I think he was like the SDO or something, the squadron duty officer. But I do remember, at least for us, I don't know if it was maybe just on holidays or whatever, but I somehow drew SDO Thanksgiving night in like 1993. And my then girlfriend, now wife, God bless her, she came in and hung out with me.
Oh,
and of course, now she wouldn't do that. But, you know, but you know, it's just one of those things where like, oh, that sucks. You got to be in there. Well, I'll come in and hang out. And I forget if we just, you know, talked or whatever. But, you know, so, yeah, you do have some extra duties you might have to do just to help the squadron run day to day. But for the most part, that is your job. That is your requirement. Mm-hmm. You're not taking care of other people's, you know, evaluations or what job some enlisted man is doing or woman. That is your job, is to be a flight student.
And that's something when guys and gals check in with me, I make very clear, like, hey, your primary role in life for the next year to 2 years is to learn how to fly and be lethal in the F-18. Everything else is ancillary. If you are getting tasked out with stuff that you might not know if that's appropriate or not, come to me and I'll tell you, because your role in life is to learn how to fly and become a Hornet pilot.
Now, when I was commissioned in August of 1992, there was a big backlog of students, and I'm glad that they kept me instead of just culling a whole bunch of us out of the herd. So I didn't actually start until almost exactly a year later, August of 93. But then I was winged in July of 95, and I finished the FRS, I want to say, in fall of 96. So from now, you're not going to be able to answer this because you did your surgrad thing, but 2 years to winging and then about another year for the FRS. Is that still fairly standard?
I think so. Yeah, I remember for me, it was about probably about 3.5 because I had that extra year in there.
Of surgrad?
Of surgrad, mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you took that out of the equation, it was probably about 2.5 years. I remember when we get to Florida in Pensacola, we had a huge backlog as well.
Okay.
And I remember one time that they said, for the Marines at least, they're like, we're going to start you in flight school based on your lineal number from the basic school. So how well you did at the basic school, they're just trying to think of a fair way to rack and stack everybody. Mm-hmm. So I think I was in like the top third, bottom part of the top third, something like that. So I wasn't at the very top, but I was fairly close. I'll buy another month or so down hanging out in the beach in Pensacola.
It was
just about the right amount of time before training started. I went to Boston on vacation, and unbeknownst to me, they changed the entire way that they racked and stacked people, and they just did it alphabetically. So overnight, I went from the 80th percentile to like the 0th because I'm W. I was at the end, and that added a lot of time that I didn't have anything to do. Which we call it white space, where you just kind of not doing anything. It was fun for a while. You're in Pensacola, and I found plenty of things to do, so I wasn't worried about that. But you're there to learn how to be a combat pilot, I didn't realize kind of the career implications because later on down the road, you want to try to get through things as quick as you can and spend the majority of your time in the fleet if you can, because a lot of guys are showing up, 3 or 4 years, then hitting the fleet, and it's kind of creates some weird timing issues.
Because at least on the initial ranks, a lot of it is based off of time, at least it was in the Navy. So you go from ensign to lieutenant JG and then lieutenant JG to lieutenant almost automatically based on time, not performance.
Right.
And then from lieutenant commander, in your case, major and on, it is that way. Now, one question I always get from people, and I already know your answer because you had zero flight experience, but in your capacity as an instructor or anecdotally when you were a student and you saw other friends of yours, how big a deal is previous flight experience when you are either in basic or even in the FRS?
So I think if you kind of think, continue with the sports analogies, it's like when someone, or when you look at like a group of guys, say 12-year-old kids playing baseball, and it's just some kids get it initially, and they're better initially than maybe other guys on the team, but eventually everyone evens out at the end. At the end of the season, everyone's at about the same level of play, right? So the prior experience, initially you'd think it'd be a great benefit because, if you already know how to talk on the radio and navigate in the FAA system, that's half the battle, just finding your way around.
So, for sure.
So that's a huge advantage initially. I didn't know how to do any of that. But on the other side of that, sometimes, and I've seen this more so than not, guys and gals who have that prior experience, that prior general aviation experience, somehow have difficulties learning the Navy Marine Corps way because they bring that prior experience in kind of their habit patterns that they've developed that might not necessarily be the way or the habit patterns that the Navy and the Marine Corps want you to have. So I didn't know any better when I showed up, and I was just like, hey, you talk and I'll listen and I'll learn and do it the way you want me to do it, and it worked out pretty good. And there was some people had a lot of issues with that, and they were like, well, I have – one guy had like almost 1,000 hours. He had a commercial rating, and he was well on his way to do whatever he wanted. And then he came – I think he was in the Navy, and he struggled a lot. And, if you had just looked at that on paper, you'd think he'd be an immediate rock star, but he wasn't because he had been doing it his way for so long that by the time you get to Pensacola, it's – one way to do things, and that's the way they teach it down there, and they don't really care what you did other than that.
Right.
So it's not a big deal. If you don't have experience, it's not a big deal. That is not a disqualifier.
Yeah, I love that answer. And what I usually tell people is if you can get some time, go do it, because if nothing else, if you could at least get the butterflies out of your stomach. In other words, when I don't know, you touched on it, but you didn't really say if it afflicted you or not. I did get sick on my FAM 1. And on FAM 2, I think I got nauseous, but I held it down. And, by FAM 5 or 6, you're fine. But, if you can get just the sense of, hey, my stomach is used to this, so that's good. Get that out of the way. And at least maybe not get to the point where you're developing habits, like you said, but at least understand, oh, when I go to an airport, I have to talk to somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, some basic stuff like that. But on the other hand, if a person is willing to put in the hard work and is adaptable to things like you did, you can learn it.
You learn it. I mean, you go to an airport, and it doesn't matter if you're flying, a Cessna, 172, or you're flying a Boeing 777, you know, you find your way to the airplane, you start it up, and each plane has their own sequence, yep. And you find your way to the runway, and you have to talk to the same people. Doesn't matter what plane you're in. You have to take off and talk to the right people and fly the right way, you know, in accordance with what you're flying. So all that stuff is directly applicable. And, yeah, I think that's great advice. If you can get some, you know, I had that IFS experience, which is like maybe 5 hours, maybe in a Cessna, and I had maybe one ride other than that. I don't even think I had that. You know, I mean, I had nothing. I'm not even kidding. I had nothing going into
this. Your feet hadn't left the ground?
I had nothing. And I don't remember ever, you know, actively being sick in the plane, but I remember in one of those initial, like the second flight in that five-hour deal in a Cessna, your body just is not used to that environment. Your body is not used to being in a three-dimensional environment with, you know, you're going forward, then you're going back, and then you get hit by a gust of wind, and you're kind of kipping left and right, and your body's experiencing these weird forces on it that it's not used to, and that can be an eye-opener. I think I went home after that first or second flight, and I felt like I had just run a marathon, and I laid down on my bed, and I remember just staring at the ceiling fan going around because I was so smoked after an hour of flight, which I think I flew for like 15 minutes of the one. I didn't even do anything. I just sat there and looked out the window, and I was in my bed in the air conditioning just like, oh, my God, I am just smoked right now.
Today you could have theoretically gone out and fought BFM for 35 minutes, come back, and it's no big deal, grab a cup of Joe and go do it again.
Go do it again. And that's but that's the beauty of your body adapts, yeah, and you get used to it. And and I would say, like, I could count on less than one hand how many people couldn't adapt. So meaning almost everyone get used to it at some point, some people sooner than others. So don't worry about that. I was a kid who was growing up. I'd never wanted to go on the roller coasters. I never wanted to do those, you know, crazy carnival rides. I could not sit in the back of my parents' Dodge Caravan that we had years ago because I get car sick. I had to sit in the front. I mean, I did not. If you looked at me, you know, when I was growing up, I did not have, other than maybe a little bit of athleticism, I did not have, you know, the right stuff of what it, you would think a fighter pilot, you know, cast iron stomach and nerves of steel. I was like, I'm not going on that.
Well, that's because those aren't born. They are not created.
But that, you know, and I talked about it a little bit earlier. That's the where the will piece comes into it. You know, there was absolutely nothing that was going to stand in me becoming a fighter pilot. And I remember just having like a pep talk to myself, like, I will, if I have to throw up for as many times as possible in a plane to make this happen, I do not care. I'm going to do this.
That's right.
I am going to be a fighter pilot. And I did it.
Maybe they'll stop me, but I'm not stopping me.
Someone might pull my medical ticket and say, "Hey, Mike, this isn't your thing." But you know, there was nothing that I was going to let get in my way to make this happen.
All right, dude. Well, we have talked about flight school from commissioning to post winging, post FRS, getting to the fleet. We talked about the stages. We talked about the syllabus in those stages, the aircraft you fly, some of the preparation, what it's like, what you got to do. What else? I mean, clearly there's more, but what else is there for this subject for today? We've been at it for a little while.
Yeah, you know, I think we covered the nuts and bolts of what flight school is. I just, you know, I'll say to people who are interested in it, you know, I got, looking back on it, I got horrible advice to prepare for something like this. And it wasn't because people were trying to steer me wrong. They just didn't really know
what
it actually took. You know, you need to study this. You need to get into this field. You need to be flying this. And I'm like, okay, well, I didn't do any of that. And, you know, I did pretty good in my flying career up until this point. So the point being is, you know, if this is something that you're interested in, you know, and nowadays, I won't say that I grew up and, you know, internet wasn't a thing when I grew up, because obviously it was, but there's so many resources with, you know, with your podcast, with, you know, you go on YouTube, just go on the internet just to see and hear people's experiences and just never be afraid to ask someone, hey, what is it like when you did this? Because you'll get that human side of it. And you'll get that answer like, hey, I was a criminal justice non-technical major that had no flight experience. And now I'm the training officer of the biggest F-18 Hornet squadron in the Marine Corps. So you never know where it's going to take you. And as long as you have the desire to be successful and you put the time in and you don't let anything, because you're going to have bumps in the way, you're going to have bad events and bad days.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff's going to happen that's going to make you question, is this the right career choice? Everyone has it at some point. But you just got to buckle down and gut it out and get through it, because it is the best job in the world.
And you have to tell yourself the right story, which is you can do it because people do it. You and I did it.
Yeah.
And we're not that special, I would argue. But, you know, like you said, there is a certain level of determination and internal fortitude that's required. And if you have that, great. Of course, you also need a few physical attributes like color vision and good vision and a few other things. But I would be willing to say that anyone who can apply themselves to something and finish it could probably apply themselves to this. can do it?
You're going to be. And really, it's the reason why that's so important is not just to get through flight school or, you know, to get wings, because if you can survive the program and you can if you can thrive in that that environment and ultimately, you know, earn your wings and get out to a fleet squadron, you are going to be in some situations that are downright hairy. And you're going to have to rely on the relationships that you've built just at a personal level with your buddies in the squadron, with their wives back home to support each other. And you're going to be tried and tested in some serious, intense situations. And that's really where that stuff comes into play. It's not so much to look good on a grade sheet
right.
or to get through a certain phase in training. It's for when it matters, when there's Marines on the ground that are having a rough day and taking casualties, and they need your help and they need your weapons to go exactly where they're asking them to go. They know they just pick up the magic radio and they call the Black Knights and help is on the way. That's really what it's all about.
Excellent. Yeah, you bet. Or any Marine squadron for that matter, which is a great segue. I've got a guy lined up. We're going to talk about the Marine Air Ground Task Force.
Great.
Probably in the same month that this one comes out, September of 2018. So maybe right before the Miramar Air Show. So
oh,
for
perfect.
Those who are nearby can go listen to it and then go check it out.
So yeah, come on out.
We'll talk about Marine aviation a little bit on a future episode. So we'll wrap this up. BS, you know the drill here. Last couple questions. You're living large. Coronado, great family, got a good gig. You're still flying F-18s. What's the future hold, though?
Yeah, so we're kind of coming down on the wire from my time in the Marine Corps. I think I'm probably going to step out around December, and I just got offered a slot to go fly F-15Cs for the Mass National Guard. So being a Boston guy and Caitlin's a Boston gal, and all our family and stuff are back up there. I couldn't think of a better way to continue flying, but in my state, flying a pretty incredible airplane.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to do that in the short run, and then ultimately, I'd like to kind of get into a mix with the National Guard and you know hook up with a major airline and kind of work the airline route.
For sure.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, we may have to invite you back, and you can talk to us about the difference between the Hornet and the Eagle. We haven't done that yet. It's on my list. And there's plenty of other guys, of course, that could also talk to it. But we like you now. You spent a lot of time with us today. Thanks very much. All right. And the last thing is, I haven't even barely used your call sign, but we always ask our guests, how did someone or did you maybe come up with BS?
Yeah. So I didn't have a call sign. I didn't really have anything coming to my fleet squadron. And some people just call me random names.
okay.
So that didn't last that long.
They were waiting for you to do something stupid.
I guess so. Yeah. I was trying to keep my nose clean and trying to put my bombs where they should go and put my airplane where it needed to be. So I didn't pick up anything crazy. But I had my whole family's firemen back in Boston. My dad, my older brother, my uncle, and when the Boston Marathon bombing went down, we just actually come back from a flight, and they were playing it in the radio room, and you know, you see all, you know, what happened that day.
Yeah.
And I remember, I knew my dad was on duty that day, and I knew he was heavily involved in that. And I was like, oh man, I hope everyone's okay. And, it was a pretty rough day across the board. But
anyway,
so in the fallout of that, the whole like Boston Strong, you know, slogans and stuff started coming on t-shirts, bracelets and all that, which is pretty neat. So my CO, he knows I'm a Boston guy, and I made it a point every day to inform my squadron mates of the superiority of Boston athletics and just everything in Boston in general, which they were pretty much annoyed at that point with that. But so he's like, we're just going to call you Boston Strong. And I was like, oh, man, these guys are never going to – they're going to tear me apart for that. And I could see my my opso at the time was in the back as this was going down. Who was Putty Shoup, who's now an F-35 CO.
Cool.
And he just threw the eye roll of the century when that went down. I'll never forget his facial expression. I was like, oh, this isn't gonna last. So the next day, there was a guy who was supposed to go out on a flight that got, I think he got med down or something like that. He couldn't make it. So Putty called me up and he said, hey, we have two Red Air and we have an instructor. Can you do, a section lead event, which is, a workup event to be a two-ship flight lead? And I wasn't even remotely prepared for it. And I, in true, Marine fighter pilot, I totally made it up. And I was like, oh, yeah, let's do it. Of course I'm ready for this. Absolutely not. 100% not ready for it. Wasn't even remotely close. And it was with Putty, was the evaluator. So we go in the briefing room, and it was, I think it was 2v2 BFM. So for my stage in the game, a very complex brief in and of itself, never mind the actual flight. So, I go to the brief, and this is going to be terrible. And I just kind of breeze my way through this brief, and I can just, Putty is less than impressed. He was a former MOTS, which is the Marine Weapons School.
Right.
Former MOTS instructor pilot, very capable guys, obviously a commanding officer right now. And he just kind of, he's not even taking notes. He just looks at me and he's like, are you done with that BS? For lack of it, he didn't use the term BS. Okay. He used the full term. And I said, yep, I'm done. Let's go fly. And he was like, thank God. And he could just get up and get out. So that just kind of stuck from there. Guys just kind of started calling it that because I BS my way through that brief and somehow he let me go flying.
And the Boston Strong. So you could almost call it that one too. Huh?
Yeah, it started there and then that didn't last. That lasted about a minute. And then I totally did that and the rest is history.
All right. Well, I don't think we've had anyone yet who's earned one out of a brief. Okay, that's a good one.
Yeah, there's probably some other stuff that may or may not have played into that, but we'll leave it
there. All right, well, good. Yeah, we'll keep this PG. Plus, you know, we don't want to know that you self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, once they start calling you that, then you have to earn it kind of thing. So
yeah,
hopefully not.
There's some interesting ones out there.
Excellent. All right, Mike, well, that was an awesome discussion. I hope young people who hope to do what we had the opportunity to do will enjoy this and learn something from it. And, of course, it could change by the time they get there, but it gives them a rough idea of what to expect and what our experiences were, and that's the best we can do on this show. So I want to thank you for your – how many years of service now?
Coming up on 13 now.
13, okay. Yeah. Well, thanks for your service, and probably you can hopefully get to 20 with the reserves there. And thanks for your time today. And unless you got any other parting shots, I think we can wrap this up.
No, that's it, Joe. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. All right, man. Let's get out of here.
All right, cool.
Whew. All right. Well, I hope you hung with us and stayed awake through all that. I'm sure you did because that's exciting stuff. And that interview actually went for about an hour and a half. And I had to cut a lot of it out because I just didn't think it would all fit in one episode. So we're going to take some of the excerpts and put them in the Patreon Fighter Pilot Podcast page for different leveled supporters. So if you're into that, look for that to come out right after this episode. And if you're interested in that, head over to patreon.com and look for Fighter Pilot Podcast. All right. So Mike Walsh, BS, thanks, dude. Appreciate your time coming on the show. And I know everybody enjoyed our time together. And in fact, everybody, he only lives a couple streets over from me in Coronado, as fate would have it. So I told him that I'm going to talk him into a Facebook Live session where we can answer some questions because we are not going to have time to do it on this episode. But that being said, I do need to explain a couple more terms very quickly that we went over in our discussion. One is that at some point he said RAC, and I think he explained that that was a replacement aircrew. But then later he said a Cat 1 RAC. And so what he means by that is that somebody who's going through the training for the very first time, they are a Cat 1. If someone has been through training in something else, let's say an F-14, and then they are transitioning to an F-18, well, then they might come through as a Cat 2 because they're not brand new, but they are new to the Hornet. And then your Cat 3 and Cat 4 are kind of people who maybe flew the F-18 before but are coming back after a little time off. So those are just some of the ways the FRSs categorize their students. And then Surgrad, if you don't recall that from Mongo's discussion on the MGKill from Desert Storm, that is where they take a recently graduated student and keep him as a selectively retained graduate to instruct at the training command, and that's what BS did, just like Mongo. Now, MOTS, as in MOTS 1, is the Marine Aviation Weapons and Tactics Squadron 1 based in Marine Corps Air Station Yuma, Arizona, and it does a little bit like what Top Gun does, but a much bigger team picture with other players than just the strike fighters, and I'm hoping to have an episode on that someday, so we'll just leave it at that for now. The other thing we want to talk about is the Air Force side of things. Sometimes students go to Air Force flight school, and sometimes Air Force flight students come through the Navy's flight school. And as I said in the interview, I have an Air Force volunteer who I'm hoping to corral into talking about this very same subject. In fact, I'll probably make him listen to this episode first, and we're going to do it from the Air Force point of view. So stay tuned for that. And then the last thing is I finally dug out my old logbooks and found out that I made about 285 passes at a carrier at night. Now, the good news is 263 times I landed successfully, but there were 4 touch and goes, and I think that was during probably FRS training because normally touch and goes at night are just awful. And yes, there were 18 bolters at night, so I don't know. I think that boarding rate's only little less than 94%, which isn't great. But hey, I was blue collar. I tell you that all the time. And I'm still alive, so all the airplanes are still workable. I'll count that as a success. All right, well, this is a much longer than normal episode, so we're going to wrap it up with that. Before we do, let me simply tell you one more time that the last weekend of September is the big Southern California Air Show at Marine Corps Air Station Miramar, and I will be there on Saturday the 29th. Now, admission, parking are free. There are different booths and chalets and grandstands you can pay for, and of course, other things you may want to buy, but entry to enjoy the show is free. It is headlined by the Blue Angels. It's going to be a great time. And as we get closer towards the event, I will put out more detail because I think it's looking like I'll be able to spend most of the day in a chalet, and I want to let you know which one that is in case you want to come in and join me all day. And then at some point during the day, I'll sneak out of there and go park probably under the wing of the C-5 Galaxy, which will be there, I'm told. It's the biggest airplane, so you can't miss it. I'll probably just be under the right wing from a certain time to another certain time with my polo on, and you can come find me and we'll shake hands and talk, and maybe I'll bring some stickers or something. But anyway, we'll talk more about that later. But for this episode, we're all out of time. We'll see you next time right here on the Fighter Pilot Podcast. Oh, and real quick on your way out the door, let me remind you that the views expressed in this presentation are the personal views of myself and my guest and do not necessarily represent the position of the Department of Defense or its components.
Thank you for listening to the Fighter Pilot Podcast. Got a question for the show? Send an email to questions@fighterpilotpodcast.com or leave a message on our listener line at 877-MACH-101. That's 877-622-4101. Be sure to check out our website at fighterpilotpodcast.com. You can also find us on all the usual social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. For exclusive Fighter Pilot Podcast content and to help support the show, visit our Patreon page. Please like, follow, and share us with your network. And if you have a moment to leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, we would greatly appreciate it.
Oh man.
Hopefully you got what you needed.
I think we kind of jumped all over the bullseye, but I think we hit it. So thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post 9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.